Hi, welcome to RetroTech. We're here with some of the team members from Encarta. Why don't you all introduce yourselves?
Hello, I'm Mark McKenzie. I worked at Encarta for many years as a designer and program manager.
I'm John Peretti. I worked on Encarta for all, starting as just a developer and worked all the way up to being the last dev lead.
I'm Stefan Como. I was a media author at Encarta from 98 to 2006, I think.
I'm Bruce Morgan. I was one of the devs on Encarta in 96. I started in January of 95. I was a dev lead on the team, and I eventually went up to dev manager before I left the team in 2003.
So I read that the buttons were designed to look like rectangular buttons on amplifiers and tape decks. Can anyone share a story with us about how something was designed in Encarta?
Well, I worked on the design team for several years, and as I recall, Encarta 95 had a UI redesign that was slightly before I joined the team. And in that redesign, all of that skeuomorphism, the appearance of a physical thing, having a button on the interface looked like a button on an amplifier, that was removed in Encarta 95, and the interface was flattened and turned into more of a 2D interface. And that became the first step in a journey in Microsoft design that led 10, 12 years later to the Metro design language. And one of the principles there was authentically digital. It's not pretending to be a thing that it wasn't, not pretending to be a physical button, but an actual 2D thing on the screen. Prior to Encarta 95, the interface did have gadgets and buttons that simulated real-world objects. And I think that the design world in those days was learning how to make interfaces for this new multimedia environment. And a lot of different things were tried. And I'm sure that buttons on old-fashioned media gadgets were inspirations for some of the original designs. But over time, the design team, not just at Encarta, but across Microsoft and really across the multimedia industry, moved towards a more authentic digital system. That's my take on it.
What's something we might not know about Encarta that you all can share?
Well, there were some interesting Easter eggs.
Oh, that's true.
I mean, one point I remember, I think it was 98, the year I showed up, the Easter egg was there was a hidden article with everybody's dog. Was that one?
Yes, I remember that.
Yeah. I think they stopped us from putting in Easter eggs after a few years.
They did.
That was just because of disk space, wasn't it?
It became a corporate edict that if you had time to put that stuff in.
And you had time to fix another button.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. Yeah. There was still some we shoved in after that. But
one of the other Easter eggs was guided tours. Yeah. Guided tours was a feature where you could go on articles like all the national parks or all the states, and there was a guided tour you could go to, and everybody got to pick an entry for themselves. Mm-hmm.
The last one I remember was we had a new feature. It was a related article visual carousel that the cards would circle around, and we put a secret one in there with everybody's name in it and the org chart, basically. So you could click on a manager and that would bring up his organization. You could click on one of those and it would bring up the next level.
So I wonder if anybody still knows how to get at any of those Easter eggs.
I have not.
It would have required some sequence of keyboard presses or
usually
holding
hold
down,
the shift key down while click the feature
or
something, a couple of things like that.
I think I seem to recall
one was hold the shift key down and you're in a feature and it's spelling card out and you got to the Easter egg that way.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool. I know I talked with someone earlier and they said that there was, I think the one with the pets, that Easter egg, it's something about you hit Control 99. That's what they think that it was in, so I'm going to check that out.
That sounds about right.
What was the best part of working on Encarta?
The people. The team.
Yes, absolutely.
It was a great team of people. This was the late 90s. Go, go, go. Microsoft late 90s. The dot-com era was coming up. And we were transitioning from, make a client product, ship in a box. And the world's doing it. And we got the internet tidal wave memo from Bill, and we had to put the internet into the product, whatever that meant. And everybody's really excited to work on it. It was a really smart team of people. We felt like we were doing good in the world, shipping. Mm-hmm. You know, I had school-age kids in the later years, and they could use the product.
Yeah, the people were great to work with. It was one of the best teams. It was the best team I ever worked on. But to the last point that you made, the thing that I loved most about Encarta was I felt like it was a worthwhile project. That we were making something. We were making something that millions, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of school children around the world would be using to enhance their education. And there wasn't anything else like it. That we were creating a new world, a new vehicle for education that hadn't existed before, and it really felt worthwhile. Mm-hmm. Like we're making a difference.
Yeah, absolutely. And people were dedicated to that.
Yes, absolutely.
Right, we talked about, products were focused on the users who were going to use the product. The features were aimed toward fulfilling user needs. Mm-hmm. We weren't trying to make something to wrap in ads. We weren't trying to do gadget wear that would try to get you to clicks and eyeballs. We had real products that did real things for real people.
Going back to what Mark was just talking about, it's funny because even today, we were just talking about this, that even today when you mentioned, I worked on Encarta, that a lot of people will come up and say, I loved Encarta. That was my favorite thing. It's still very gratifying. So.
But sadly, it's all evaporated. It doesn't exist anymore. You can't find Encarta anywhere. You can't find any of the content we created. You can't find any of the articles we wrote. It's gone. And generations of people are growing up now having never even heard of it, let alone having benefited from it. So it was a moment in time, and we made the most of it. And that was the beauty of it. The sadness of it for me is that it disappeared.
Yeah, I hear you. What was y'all's favorite, least favorite feature?
Well, I could go with that one. The what's the name of the feature? The 3D tours, the Parthenon, and things like that.
What do we call it? 3D virtual tours.
3D virtual tours.
Yes, 3D virtuals.
The feature's a cool feature, and I saw on Twitter that people loved it, and I'm really glad they did. Right. So I guess I was wrong because I was against this feature from the beginning because the 3D engine wasn't. I was a dev manager. Yeah. Right, so I'm concerned about schedules and pressure and risk, and it used too much memory. It wasn't done yet. The models were huge. The models were late. They were buggy and glitchy. Yeah. Whenever 3D virtual tours loaded up, we had to load up the article engine on top of it to show things, and we barely ran on our minimum requirements already.
Bruce, I was the program manager for that feature.
and you might remember some of those.
You were right. It was a wonderful, promising feature, and it was innovative and groundbreaking, and it was ahead of its time in the good way and in the bad way. And it was a very difficult project to get shipped. The good news is that a lot of consumers loved it, and the bad news is it was very difficult for us as a product team to get the thing built and delivered.
Yeah, we had a big go no go meeting on that. Jim Oker and I were, and Jim was on the go side, and I was on the no side. Yeah. But we ultimately did ship that product. I think we took a schedule slip. What's new? Yeah. And we ended up shipping with it. Computers move on. It got better for the next version.
Yeah. But and compared to what's available today, 20 years later, the stuff was very, very primitive, very primitive. But at the time, it was leading edge, and it's an example of just how fast things move, and in the computer world and software and multimedia world, today we're generations past where we were at that time with that feature, which at that time was unlike anything anybody had ever seen before. But it was buggy. I mean, you could walk through the wall of the Parthenon.
I did that.
There were all kinds of little crevices you could discover in the walls of these buildings that hadn't actually been there. But we were aware of that. We were aware of how buggy it was and how difficult it was to ship. But I think end users, they're unaware of that. Right. What they were aware of is, oh my God, I can walk through the Colosseum and the Roman Forum and Abu Simbel and be introduced to these places that otherwise there was no other way. There was no other way at that time to immerse yourself
in those environments. We took all that amazement and totally for granted because we were seeing all the problems actually getting into shippable condition.
And one of the things we did well is we hid all that agony from the consumer. You know, the consumer, all they got was the coolness, and they didn't know how much we sweated to get that stuff shipped.
Right. Speaking of agony, though, it's kind of cool. Like when I started, we seemed to have like a death march every year to ship the product.
Sure.
By the time we were like 2003, 2004, it seemed like we had it down. And we were much more confident.
You're welcome.
But I mean, the 98 was a particularly difficult year. It was my first year. And then by the time we were last years of the product, it seemed like the whole team, we'd have our plan together. Like almost as soon as we shipped the previous one, we'd have the next one kind of all scoped out. And we'd cut features 6 months before ship date so we wouldn't have these stress moments.
We moved our ship date up. We used to try to make Christmas, and then we decided we'd make, like everybody did, and then we decided we'd make back to school because we're an encyclopedia. And so we shipped moved our ship date up to like May or June. There used to be the running joke of what date should you pick for your vacation, summer vacation? Ship date, because you know it's going to slip. There was a time, though, we did actually make a date, and I know Amy Raby was the dev manager at the time, and she had a vacation scheduled the next day. And we made it. Shipped the product. She took her vacation.
Well, we got better at it every year. You know, not a lot of turnover on that team. People stayed on that team, and year after year, we had this annual cycle: plan, build, debug, and ship. And we got better at it every year. And having the same people working on the same thing, we got to be the machine got well oiled.
Yeah.
You know, it's to everybody's credit that we were able to do that. Of course, today everything's different. There's no more annual ship cycle. There's no more finished goods. You know, you make an update, you prop it that day.
And then we ship daily.
You ship hourly in some cases. Yeah. You know, everything is live now. So all the lessons we learned in those days, you know, apply to some extent today. But we were working with very different constraints at that time.
Mm-hmm. So I wanted to ask about the maps, because that's one thing that the customers still talk about, is about how much they love the maps, and they have a lot of rich histories around the maps. Can anyone talk about about that process? Like, how do the maps look so good? Like, can anyone talk about that? Because it seemed like from reading the specs and things that was very difficult, obviously, to do. And so can anyone talk a little bit about that?
Well, there was a whole Encarta Virtual Globe product. I don't think any of us worked on it exactly.
We worked on it later on. So there was Bookshelf, and there was Encarta Encyclopedia, and there was Encarta Virtual Tours that turned into Encarta Atlas when there was a rebranding, right? And eventually, and that was the reference suite. All three, you could get Bookshelf and Encarta and the Atlas product together. And there was a separate Atlas team who did, and they did a great job making those maps look great.
Well, I mean, just the maps in Encarta itself.
It was
just
merged
like
in
any
later
of those
on.
Visuals.
So there's the Earth globe that you could spin around. That's the Atlas product. But their earlier versions just had bitmap images.
That's what
and
I
maps.
Mean.
Okay, that's the ones you mean.
So and it's hard for us actually to talk about which one you're talking about, because almost every year we had to have a different process for how we would create the maps.
Oh.
So it depends a lot on which year. Like Bruce was saying, the early ones were bitmaps, and a lot of them were hand-tuned, and that's why they look so good. At least you would know better than I do, but that's my understanding. But as we got later on, and we were shrinking the team because we were competing against the internet, that became too expensive. So we ended up, actually, by that time, we had bundled the Atlas in with Encarta as the same product. So we would actually punch a hole into the window, into the browser window that we're using to render it, and actually show the virtual globe maps through that hole. It was kind of I'm really surprised that worked.
And it became interactive that way. You could zoom in and out. You could pan around on the map. Where in earlier versions they had just been static bitmaps, and they were great bitmap maps, but that's all it was a picture essentially. And when it became interactive in later versions, again, that was incredibly innovative, and there was nothing else like that at that time.
Right. We were the multimedia encyclopedia, right? So we had a multimedia. So yes, the maps were a big selling point. Back of box feature.
Yeah.
You remember back of box?
Yes. Yeah, I really like the sounds and the music and then just even the swooshes and the click, click, click and all of that. Like we were talking earlier about the pinpointer, and there's just so many little things like that that for me, I'm just like, this is so fantastic. And this sticks with me now. And I think, oh, this is what, you know, UIs used to look like. And then I read about the colors that you all used. And I thought that was really interesting. That was like, I guess out of everything, the whole color palette was the most interesting thing that I read, because it's cool for me to think, wow, in the 90s, we were thinking about accessibility and we were thinking about like things like that. And that's really cool to me. So can any of you talk a little bit about the colors or the color palette?
I learned a lot about that from reading that thread on Twitter and what you wrote up about how the palette was managed. And I mean, the reality at that time was that everything had to fit onto a disc, and it was a challenge every year to squish the stuff down and use compression to make things as small as possible so that we could get as much content as possible onto the disc. And as I understand it from your thread, we had a certain number of colors that we used for the UI, and then the rest of the 256 color palette would be determined in context in order to render what needed to be rendered at that moment in the encyclopedia. And I think that's fascinating. I'd love for you to talk more about how that worked.
Yeah, so we ran on 256 color devices, but we needed to show a lot of different pictures that didn't share the same 256. So I think it was 20. We had 20 UI colors or 16 UI colors.
Yeah, something around that.
Right, they were carefully tuned and there were constants in the code. Warm gray 1, warm gray 2. You remember those?
Yes.
Cyan and all the different colors. And you could pick your, you could draw your elements. So when we needed to show an article with a series of different images, we'd have to preload the images. We'd know what image, what, they were all indexed with a byte per pixel into the color palette for that image, right? It wasn't the 3 bytes per
right.
pixel, it
That's
was 1 byte per
right.
pixel, or and compressed. And that would pick what palette entry that went along with it. That photo might have 82 image colors, it might have 17 colors, it might have 100 colors.
Yeah.
We'd average pick, merge up a color palette that had the first 20 reserved for the UI and the rest to try to average out all the pictures. We'd repalletize all the images. Then pick, and then you'd have to realize the palette for that application.
Exactly.
All the other windows would flicker if Encarta wasn't maximized, because the colors just all changed.
Right.
But then we'd get the best optimized pictures, because we were the multimedia encyclopedia,
yeah.
so
right.
we needed to look good.
One of the great challenges at that time across the whole industry was working with 256 color displays and making images and videos look good with that limited palette, and managing palettes and loading and unloading palettes. And Encarta was again at the leading edge of doing that very well,
right.
and that continued to be an issue, you know, later on with early. Internet-based media streaming, where you had a 14.4 modem, and even if displays could now display millions of colors, you still had to get the images you were streaming down this thin pipe down to the smallest possible size. So you were still compressing images down to 256 color palettes and trying to optimize for that. That problem was a major problem to solve in almost any kind of multimedia you were building and delivering. Throughout the 90s, and nobody thinks about that anymore. Everything is, you know, millions of colors, and nobody and broadband delivery,
right.
and it's just
right.
It,
there's
it's
a lot. There's, there anymore. There are people today who will run tools to compress their websites, right? So they'll run better on a phone or the like. But the degree of work we had to do just to fit,
And one of the primary tools in a designer's toolbox in those times was a tool called Debabilizer, which would evaluate a whole series of images and come up with the best possible palette to apply to all those images. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the many things you could do with Debabilizer. You had to be good with Debabilizer because palette management was one of the top things you had to deal with in building multimedia in those days.
Another thing, though, is the compression. Like Bruce was talking about, the different compression algorithms that you could do with images like that was a kind of a tug of war, because on one side we were trying to get as small as we could, right? But on the other side, we had to have them be as beautiful as possible. So we would try every single algorithm to compress the images that we could think of on different versions of it. And then bring them to the artists and say, which one do you like better, A or B, you know, and then try and figure it out. And then a lot of the early versions, at one point we switched our rendering engine to be a more of a Trident IE based engine. But because we were using non-standard compression, we couldn't actually use just an image tag to show those things. We actually had to write our own display rendering control. So.
Does anybody have any short stories that they want to share that kind of pop out that are like, you know what, I would like to talk about that? Any like warm, fuzzy moments or things maybe where you were, that you always remember about Encarta?
I remember the time when I was working on the content management system. So the Encarta articles started out as SGML markup, and then they later turned out into RTF Word documents where you'd make hyperlinks between things and comments, and then we'd convert the RTF documents into a SQL database, and they'd have all the hyperlinks. I botched all the hyperlinks in the entire product. My code that did the confirmation, and we lost every hyperlink, all the correct links. So if you were in the United States article and you clicked on a link to the state, it wouldn't go to the state, it would go to someplace else.
This is warm and fuzzy, Chris.
Oh yes, it was. So after freaking out that I just broke all our content, I had to write a tool that basically figured out how to reconnect the link. So if you were in an article that had if the text was like Alaska, and there was an article named Alaska, and they matched, we code that green, right? That was a correct link. And so every article had to go through a tool that would try to fix every hyperlink and then it would suggest, okay, it's going to Mount Everest, but the link doesn't actually go to Mount Everest, but we found an article that's Mount Everest that we have high confidence, do you want to accept this? And it ran through all of our 90,000 or 80,000 articles at the time.
Yeah.
And I remember running this on 5 machines in 5 different offices and going through picking this, and I had to fix every article. And we successfully did this, but then I was showing this tool to some of the editors, and they thought, well, this is a great tool. So we turned it into a hyperlink editing tool so that if you wanted to link to an article, you could just select the text in the editor, and then we'd suggest a list of articles you should
link to. There's the warm fuzzy there. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So save the day and ended up with a good tool. Yeah.
I'm sorry Control-Z wasn't available.
Control-Z, undo.
I think working with the international teams was kind of cool too. We had content partners in the UK and Germany and France and Japan, Sweden at one point, probably forgetting some.
Denmark,
yeah. And you know, some of the stuff I dealt with, the interactive stuff. So in the early days, when I first started, we literally would make our interactivities in Macromedia Director, little interactive thing, we put them on a disk with the source files and we'd send them to Germany and France and say, hey, hire somebody local or get somebody on your staff to localize this and send it back. And then you get back a disk with how they tried to localize it. Some of them were excellent, some of them not so much. I remember one thing that was funny is by that time in the late 90s, people didn't smoke in the office in the US, but some of the Europeans still did. So I distinctly remember opening an envelope and going like, ooh.
Anybody else?
Oh, just the people, I think, for me. Everybody there was so dedicated. We had at Microsoft, sometimes you have like a really successful product and that's got lots of money, right? We were a really successful product, but since we were an educational product, we didn't have a lot of money because the educational market is very, very thin. Schools, for example, have very tight budgets. But a lot of people, and usually in other teams at Microsoft, you might find somebody who like will go to those big teams because, oh, that's where like everything is going. But everybody in Encarta was there because they loved the product. And they were there because they were just really dedicated to it. And yeah, they probably could have gotten a better promotion in another team or like a bigger team to lead if they went to a different group, but we just all loved what we were working on. So it wasn't a lot of turnover.
That's awesome. Anything else? All right. What were some of y'all's favorite topics of Encarta? Like if you were to think about
dogs.
One thing that I found out by accident by working on, it was a great thing to work on Encarta because, and it was also an occupational hazard. You'd like change the formatting of the article and then you'd have to run an article to make sure you did it right. you bring up a random article and you start reading it, and like 20 minutes later you realize, yeah. Oh wait, I got to get back to work, right?
Yeah.
So there's so much random stuff. Like, I learned that pineapples are a member of the air plant family. I was like, wow, who knew? So, just lots
that was
of
a big stuff. Occupational hazard.
Yeah.
That's why I always used American Civil War, Seattle dogs, and a couple right. other articles to test everything, because I had them almost memorized, yeah. and then I wouldn't get lost. And find myself, you know, an hour later, okay, that was fun, but now I...
Yeah, it's what happens today. You sit down, you start looking at something on the computer, and you click at something else, you click on something else, and all of a sudden, you know, you've spent 2 hours, you know, on YouTube, and you're a million miles away from where you started, and you had no intention of doing that in the first place. You just got sucked into that. And Carter was the first thing that did that.
Yep.
You know, you'd start clicking around and you'd lose track of where you were, and you'd lose track of time. And it was a beautiful thing. Mm-hmm. I don't remember any particular articles that stand out in my memory. I do remember looking at all the animations and looking at all the interactivities and looking at and playing sounds mm-hmm. and just, you know, just clicking around and just enjoying the multimedia. We put the multi in multimedia, and that was a new thing at that time. And just to be able to explore all these different media types and play them, that I do remember that.
My favorite's definitely the timelines we did in Encarta Africana.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right.
I think those were some of the most beautiful things I've ever worked on in my career, and I've worked on a lot of things, and those were just so visually beautiful and strikingly well done.
You know, that still works really well. Yesterday, I fired up Encarta 2006 mm-hmm. on my 3-monitor 4K and stretched the timeline across all 3 monitors. Looks great. Still mm-hmm. works.
Wow. That's my favorite.
Wow.
Half of the year, it still works.
It still works great.
And thanks for calling out Encarta Africana, because it doesn't get mentioned often. And it is one mm-hmm. of the richest and most beautiful products, I think, that we ever made. It had a very short lifespan again, which is sad. But it is worth mentioning and remembering that was part of the Encarta family.
I also really like the sounds, just like the narration and things like that. So one of the things that I read, I think, in one of the specs is that, and you all can chime in at any point, but there was something about the voices that they use for narration. Like, someone had to actually try out where they had to record themselves on a tape, and then it had to be played on the computer to make sure it sounded good. And they made sure there was a 50-50 split between men and women. And sometimes people that worked on the product wanted to record narration for the product. Like,
sometimes it wasn't that they wanted to, sometimes it was a necessity.
It was expedient in some cases.
Okay.
I did a couple of VO bits on just because it was expedient. We needed to get something, you know, done today. We didn't have time to, you know, go through the regular process. Mm-hmm. And there was professional narration and voiceover all through the product. But you know, sometimes being quick was more important than being excellent, I guess, or being let's just say being timely sometimes was the most important thing.
So if I fire up Encarta, is it y'all anywhere? Like, your voices anywhere on anything that you're willing to say?
I think there were two clips of mine in the Encarta collage feature.
I love the collage.
You like the collages, yeah.
Yeah. So which one?
Oh, I think I read a bit from The Unbearable Lightness of Being in one of the collages, and I can't remember which collage that was.
You guys are mentioning features. They're like, oh, that was an awesome feature. I didn't even remember we had that.
Well, we built
features. Yeah. We had lots of features, and some feature ideas, we retire features on occasion. Yeah. Or we put features back in.
Well, there were some features that didn't touch the dev team because we built them in Director and played them with the Shockwave plugin, mm-hmm. which I know had a lot of pros and cons. I know that it was not popular in the dev community because, you know, we were embedding this runtime engine that was built by, you know, that was a third-party engine, and we kind of lost, you know, we weren't able to do, you know, some of the crafting that we maybe would like to have done. But it allowed us as media authors and designers to create and ship stuff that we wouldn't have been able to do otherwise. And some of the very rich content that we made, including collages and interactivities, was only possible because we were using we were using a third-party engine, and not hitting our dev team, not requiring our dev team to build things.
Because this is the days when, like, famous paintings, I coded famous paintings. It's all done by hand.
Yeah.
You code the whole feature to work the way it's supposed to work, all by hand. Today, you have many different tools that you could do a feature like that instead of writing C++ code.
I'm glad you brought that up. So another thing that I really liked in the specs and the postmortems was at the end of, I guess it was in the postmortems, there was a section where it would list all the languages that were used to build Encarta that year. And then it would list the pros and cons of each and if that language was going to be used in the future. So it was interesting for me to read that because I'm reading about, okay, there was C++, there was Visual Basic, and then was there any, those are the two big ones that I remember.
C-sharp as well.
Oh yeah, yeah, C-sharp. But I remember there in one of the specs, there was some, or the postmortems, there was something about Visual Basic was really quick to get things done, but then like to get up to like 80%, and then in the last 20%, it was really difficult to use it. So what about like programming challenges or anything like that that you all remember?
That was my first job, was working on the MFC port, because we ported to the Microsoft Foundation classes, which was a big thing in the 90s, because it was a C app porting to C++, and how to create a large scale app from that. The languages we used, I don't remember C sharp. That must have been after I left.
Yeah, it was probably right after you left.
But the Visual, I think, was it Visual Basic or it was probably a scripting language, right? Because JScript was our version of JavaScript and had VBScript, maybe not Visual Basic itself, but VBScript. Yeah, probably the same thing. But when we switched to using the Trident engine instead of MediaView for our article display, we started using HTML and CSS and XSLT transforms, and some interactions on the page were written in VBScript, right? And getting them to load and do the correct thing was pretty challenging because you're inside and inside and inside. You're writing, you have a host MFC application that is in turn hosting the web browser control. Then that web browser control is in turn hosting a pluggable protocol so they can pull and download the article content. Debugging tools, put up a dialogue, beep. Right, I'm here. My code just executed. It was very hard to get anything.
Wow.
Yeah, our tools are very primitive.
Didn't we have to do a couple of tries to get the Trident thing? Didn't we try 1 year and have to pull back and do it again?
No,
actually we did. Under Amy, we tried it the first time.
Right,
but it was the hardware that we had to run on, especially for the educational market, was not up to par to run.
Yeah, right. Performance issues.
It was the IE5.5 engine we switched
first time. 2000 or so.
Right, and Brian Mantos and I worked on that for a long time. I remember the time when we took MediaView, took MediaView out and we put a red X box, a box with a red X. And if you see any red X's, it's a spot we've missed.
Yeah.
Turns out we had lots of red X's. And then we'd have to re-implement that content to be able to be displayed.
Mm-hmm.
And the funny thing, of course, for me is that we switched to using the Trident engine to render it. And then years later, I am the dev on the IE team owning the web browser control. And Encarta becomes a Windows application compatibility gate test for Windows and IE. And so I have to fix bugs in IE that break Encarta.
That's great.
But Bozo thought this was a good idea. Oh, that was me.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it still is a test for Windows to make sure that we can still run these apps.
Mm-hmm. That's one of the ongoing taxes with any product that ships over and over again is that eventually you got to build on a new foundation. You've got to refactor the whole thing to work on some new framework. And the goal for the year becomes make the thing work like it used to work.
Right.
Yeah.
And the end user doesn't necessarily see what's new this year. Oh, it's on this new foundation. But it's a tax that you have to pay as a development team to modernize the app framework.
Yeah, Trident gave us a rich flow-based layout at runtime. Right. Yeah. Beforehand, the layout is done at build time. And you can't do a lot of transformations. So you had to hand create a contents page and the article page. And then Trident gave us the ability to have a contents page and article page that are the same basic it's a transform of the article.
So you take a year to get the thing working like it used to work on the new foundation. Parity. And then the new foundation allows you to do all kinds of things you couldn't do before.
Yes.
Yeah. But just getting back to parity with last year's version and working the same.
But in the end game, in the later years of Encarta, I think we learned from our mistakes in the past, like you were talking about, like going so far in this language and then trying to push it all the way to the end. And because what our perspective was in the later years was use the right language for the job. So if this language gets you like 3/4 of the way there and then you can get the other 1/4 in a different language, do it. The last versions of Encarta, MFC, C++, C#, some still the VB script, a lot is JScript, XSL, XSLT, XML, whatever we could think of, Flash, whatever worked best for that feature, that's what we would do. So there wasn't a lot of hubris about, no, we need to use this language because that's the right language to use. You know, it was no, this one's going to get us there better. So,
can you talk a little bit about the the UI stuff that you did? I forget the name, but it's the thing that has the different categories, and then there's like a blue background.
Encarta Explorer.
Can you talk a little about that?
We did that with Macromedia Shockwave. It was basically you would start with a central nexus in the page, and as you clicked, the first things you'd be presented would be really broad topic areas like biology or politics or history, and you'd click and it would zoom out, and there would be the surrounding issues, the surrounding nodes around the topic you picked, and you could dig in, what, 3 or 4 levels?
Yeah.
And it was kind of a way to expose a lot of content in kind of a zoomy way, because when you got down to the final nodes, you'd see like, you know, biology, you might see, you know, dogs, mammals, blah, blah, you know, topics like that. It was meant to help people get into topics easily.
Yeah, it was meant to be an engaging way to browse around the content,
right,
as opposed to just looking at a text-based, you know, table of contents. You kind of like moved around in space and got deeper and deeper into things.
Sure. Mm-hmm. We had a lot of features. We had a lot of content, right? And so content discovery and exploration, mm-hmm, had a lot of features that, like the guided tourist feature we talked about earlier, and this feature, there were lots of features that said, these are our great content.
Well, I think one of the wonderful things we introduced, certainly with an encyclopedia, the first thing you've got to address is somebody needs to look something up. They have a thing they're looking for, and you need to let them find that as quickly as possible. But the thing that we, did a lot of innovation on was just browsing. It's I'm just going to open this up and just see where it takes me.
Yeah.
And
that's
kind of a new use of an encyclopedia.
Right.
And we built a lot of features that made that fun, made it engaging. And it got people to open up Encarta and start using it, even when they weren't specifically looking for something.
And we'd use those to steer people to our crown content, right? The best stuff is what would show up there.
A lot of people who worked on Encarta grew up with the, you know, like the hard copy encyclopedias, and we love to just flip through them at randomly to find like, oh, that's an interesting article. So a lot of thinking every year was, how can we replicate that experience in the computer? Because with a search engine, right, even the Encarta search engine, you would type in what you're looking for and you're there, right? You didn't have to go to get to Iwo Jima, you didn't have to go through India or, you know, Iridium or something like that, right? You were just there. So there was a lot of thought about how can we replicate that serendipity. So.
One of the things that I looked up that was really interesting was I just looked up Microsoft, like what that article looked like, and I got basically looped into, okay, looking at Microsoft, then it's talking about MS-DOS, and it's talking about the GUI, and it's talking about that. And then it was like, okay, so then I read the related topic about Bill Gates, and then I read the article about Seattle. And when Seattle comes up, I think it's Encarta 98. Pretty sure it's 98, but a song from Soundgarden plays. And it's wild to think about that today.
That didn't happen in the books.
Yeah, exactly. And you're seeing like an old picture of the Space Needle, and you're like, oh, this is so cool. And I'm like looking through this, and then I stumble upon like the top 100 businesses in the US for revenue at that time, and I'm looking at the list, and I'm like, wow, this is so different. Like, this is crazy. And it's just interesting to like put it in today's perspective to look up things, you know, like Seattle and the population back then. And it's really interesting. Because now it's so different.
It's interesting, a lot of the articles that we were able to get because we were in Seattle, like, for example, Soundgarden, we probably had somebody actually go to find the people who were, like, manage Soundgarden and talk to them. With Sir Mix-a-Lot, there's a very long interview with Sir Mix-a-Lot that's in there that we, again, we got that because he was a local person. So it was a lot of interesting things that happened. Another thing that we were able to do was the Battleship Missouri, before it was moved out to Hawaii, used to be anchored off the coast of
Bremerton.
Yeah, Bremerton. So we sent somebody there to do a virtual tour of it. And so a lot of the stuff we were able to do was just because we were located in Seattle. It was interesting.
And we had a dedicated team working on media acquisition and licensing,
yeah.
And just going out and getting the best media that was available and creating media just for use in Encarta. We had a team of people dedicated to that. It was certainly a top priority to get engaging stuff into the articles and not just list a bunch of text.
And that was a lot of challenge around media licensing, because licensing of the image, is it licensed for Bookshelf? Is it licensed for Encarta? Is it licensed for all Microsoft? Is it licensed worldwide?
Just
is
for
it
this year, for 5 years,
is it
for
licensed,
perpetuity,
is it licensed for web use?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And a lot of infrastructure around
and we
that.
Built a ton of infrastructure around
a lot of
media
tools
licensing.
For tracking that stuff.
Right, it's media is hard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was looking at the different topics, and I was looking at sports, and I was like, oh, this will be cool. So I got looped into the sports for a while, and then I got into Michael Jordan, and then it was like the championships, and then it was just like sports, and then like an hour had passed. But it was even cool to look up sports, and to remember, oh yeah, that's what it was like that's who was popular, like. You're looking at the Cowboys and the Dolphins and like.
Interesting, you mentioned that you're using 98 and 99 that are just basically frozen in time. But that was one of the features that we added later on was Encarta updates. Mm-hmm. That you would download, you'd get a subscription for a year, and we would, you know, if the state of California elected a new governor, we'd give a small download update, and then we'd merge the article updates and new paragraphs into the old article.
This was one of the things
the Triton engine gave us was runtime layouts so that we could do dynamic article updates. Yeah. Dynamic article updates was a very big new thing introduced in 2001, in that time frame. Yeah.
You know, in the old days, when you bought your encyclopedia, you might then get an annual after that. Mm-hmm. You know, so you had your original A to Z's, and then you'd have the 1951 and the 1952 and the 1953. Well, you know, we were able to merge. We were able to actually update the content, update the article, so that after your update, your article now was fresh and had up to the current time in the article, and it wasn't just something that was stuck on the end. That's one of the beauties of being able to work with live internet content and live runtime code.
Kind of speaking of internet stuff, we were probably working on queries before the search engines were really working on queries to help. You know what would we call it? Natural language query? I think that was
NLQ. Right?
So we were thinking about how to help people find things when they didn't necessarily know the actual title of the article.
Right.
I feel like Encarta was V1 on the internet, I feel like.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good point.
NLQ was another one of the features that was huge. Used a lot of memory. Didn't produce all that great results. It was very V1. Sometimes we'd have to tweak the articles and then the NLQ would process them correctly. There was the time we had to tweak the Bill Gates article because apparently you said, who is the CEO of Microsoft? It would say Scott McNeely. Because the Sun Microsystems article had the letter CEO in Microsoft and the Bill Gates article did not. So quick, and that was a late
search engine optimization.
And that was back when the content build was scary, and we'd run the content build every 3 or 4 weeks.
Yeah.
Stand back, we're going to run a new content build.
I remember an all hands meeting where somebody was demoing a natural language query, and they asked the question, who was the first to summit Mount Everest? And you remember it was essential that they use the verb summit. You couldn't just say climb because you'd get the wrong answer, right?
Thank you all for coming, and thank you for sharing your stories. And be sure to subscribe and check out future episodes.